Hi, I'm Nick Gregoriadis, and this is the Jiu-Jitsu Brotherhood Podcast, the show for grapplers and martial artists that want to evolve both on and off the mat. Welcome to the first episode of the Jiu-Jitsu Brotherhood show for 2018. It's also the first episode that is being recorded in my new home, which is in Arizona in the United States. I arrived here a few days ago after an extremely long trip that was probably one of the toughest ones I've ever done. It was 34 hours door-to-door from where I was staying in Cape Town, South Africa, to my fiance's house here in Arizona, and it was so hard. I don't think I'm going to be on a long-haul flight again for a long, long time. So this episode is featuring a very, very interesting cat and a good friend of mine, Kit Dale. He is very well known in the jiu-jitsu community for being a free-thinking, progressive jiu-jitsu coach and an excellent competitor. And I just love this guy's views. I love the way he looks at jiu-jitsu. I love how original he is. So I think you guys are going to thoroughly enjoy this. Before we get to the actual show, please remember that you can get 10% off any of our really high quality jiu-jitsu products. That's the best way to put it. They are really high quality. If you head on over to store.jiu-jitsubrother.com, you can pick up any of our stuff. I would recommend you get a copy of my new book, which is called Beyond the Black Belt. It's the sequel to The Black Belt Blueprint. And a lot of work went into that. We got some collaborators on it as well. So it's not just stuff from me. There's a bunch of good content in there from very smart jiu-jitsu players and coaches, and amazing illustrations and pictures in there as well. It's just a lovely piece of work, and I'm very proud of it. You can get 10% off that as well. So head on over to the store and check it out. And remember, we have a sponsor, Truth Naturals, that makes really great CBD products. Please go and try some of this stuff. If you head on over to truthnaturals.co.uk and use the coupon code JJBTruth, you'll get a discount on their stuff as well. Remember, CBD can help with inflammation, which can mean better recovery after tough jiu-jitsu training sessions. Okay, guys, here we go. It is episode 25 of the Jiu-Jitsu Brotherhood Show, Kit Dale. Hey, everyone. I'm here with a very cool dude, good friend of mine, and one of the best jiu-jitsu athletes in the world. Definitely one of the best teachers as well. He is none other than the legendary Kit Dale. Kit, how the hell are you, mate?
I was a lot better until I heard that intro, and I noticed that you didn't say anything about my looks. But I'm good, mate. How are you?
Exceptionally well. Last time you and I were in the same country was just over a year ago when we were in Japan.
Yes.
It was a wild trip, dude. Wild trip. I remember I met you and your ridiculously good-looking girlfriend.
All right, don't exaggerate, mate.
She's sitting next to you, isn't she? I met you guys in, I don't know, we were in the middle of Tokyo somewhere, and I could see you were incredibly jet-lagged, which is how I've been for the last few days, man. I forgot how much those long trips can take it out of you.
Uh-huh.
I got off the plane. I think it was 3 plane rides in total. I arrived in the States on Friday evening, and I was a shell of a man. I hadn't slept for 36 hours, and I was starting to get delirious. I was basically, I don't know if you've ever experienced that, when you've gone without sleep for a long time, you almost get like high, and you start to, yeah, I was in that zone.
Yeah, I think I've done some weird stuff in that zone, especially like sometimes I'll fall asleep and like for a split second, and then I'll wake up and I won't even know what world I'm in.
Mm-hmm. Actually, I had this weird dream that the first night I went to sleep. Have you ever had a lucid dream?
Once.
Okay. Once. Can you tell me about it?
Yeah, I was in a house, and it was like a massive haunted house. But it was weird because instead of having doors from bedroom to bedroom, it was windows. So it was like I was climbing through a window to get into the next bedroom, and there were these pig-like monsters from the game Doom, I think, or Duke Nukem.
Okay.
And there was me and my brother, Adam, and we were trying to get out, and then I kind of realized that I was dreaming, and I remember thought, shit, I need to get out of this dream. So I created in my mind, I created this big ladder. It was like Inception. And I created a big ladder, and I climbed all the way to the top, and then I jumped off. And as soon as I jumped, I woke up straight away.
That's cool.
I kind of wish that I knew, you know, I'd done that again, because I probably would have done something a lot cooler than just try to wake myself up.
Well, that sounds a lot cooler than my dreams, so we'll forget about mine. But Kit, do you want to tell, for the three people in the jiu-jitsu community who don't know you, who you are, do you want to tell them a little bit about yourself and how you came to be a jiu-jitsu luminary, I think is the correct word?
Oh, man, I'd love to know what that actual word means without sounding stupid. But what does that mean?
It's my understanding, and I could be wrong, that a luminary is someone who's enlightened. Or who provides light, as in knowledge.
Yeah, let's go back to enlightened. That sounds a lot cooler.
Okay, cool.
I started jiu-jitsu in 2000, and I think I got my first taste in 2008. I was playing Australian rules football, and I was a little bit scared of some of the bigger guys, so I wanted to learn how to defend myself. So I found an MMA school. I started doing that with my cousin, Michael Shaw, who's a couple of years older than me, but we're very similar body shape. I'm probably just hung a lot better. And we were training for a little bit, and then we did some jiu-jitsu. And I remember thinking to myself, man, I'm going to smash this little guy, and he just ripped me into pieces. And I kind of thought, man, I want to do this more. So I was working full-time in a factory at the time, and I was playing football, so I didn't have a lot of time to commit to jiu-jitsu. This was 2008. So I kind of trained probably twice a week in jiu-jitsu, and then I would train twice a week in football and compete on the Saturday and then work full-time. And then about 2009, I had a knee injury with football, and it set me out for 6 months, and then I got back into jiu-jitsu. And once I got back in, I was a bit more interested in that than football, and I sort of pursued that. And then I watched a competition one day, and I saw a white belt who was a training partner of mine, and he won the division. I thought, there's no way he's going to win. And I thought to myself, well, if he can win, then I can win, so I'm going to try and compete next time. And then I got into competition, and I really enjoyed it. I remember finishing the competition, and this was kind of like the curse and the joy out of it. Was these guys come up after the competition. They said, you know, Kit, that was really awesome to watch you roll. You know, it was really, inspiring or something. And as motivating as that was, it almost led me down the wrong path, because then from then on in, I had like this, it was almost like the rat race of trying to impress people of jiu-jitsu. So I was like, okay, I've got to keep competing and I got to keep winning. Mm-hmm. And so I kept competing and I did really well. I won the blue belt Abu Dhabi the next year. I won the purple belt Abu Dhabi the year after. I got silver at brown belt the year after that. I won the Brazilian Nationals at purple belt. So I was doing really well with competition. And then I got to black belt, and I did really well my first year. I went to – I fought in the Copa Podio in Brazil, and I beat Alexandre Ciccone. I drew with Davi Ramos. I lost a match, which I think I should have won. I think the whole crowd knew I should have won against Diego Moreno, but he's a legend. It was not his fault. I just think that the referee robbed me on a couple guard passes. And lost by 2 points to Philippe Penna. And I was kind of like – there was like – probably the end of my jiu-jitsu competition era in terms of like that's what I wanted to do. And then I switched into coaching. And I remember this is where I met you, because we were speaking online. And I had a weird theory at the time that was quite, I would say, relatively unknown in jiu-jitsu at the time. There was a few people that knew it but weren't really pushing it or articulating it well. And I remember speaking to you, and I wanted to see what you thought of my opinion. And we shared a lot of the similar beliefs, but we're also, you know, different in certain aspects. And we talked about it, and then we ended up deciding to get together and do Beyond Technique, mm-hmm. the first one, which was an amazing success. And I really couldn't believe, especially as someone that's worked so hard to try and make a little bit of money in my life with normal jobs, to make what we made in such a small amount of time with – and it wasn't a lot of work on my behalf. I know you worked a lot harder with the marketing and stuff, but the ideas were kind of already in my head, and it kind of drove me down the path of helping people in jiu-jitsu. And I was like, man, this is really cool. I enjoy teaching more than I enjoy competing, and it was because of pressures. And what ended up happening, I ended up having a bit of time off from jiu-jitsu in terms of competition, and then I hurt my knee, and I was gone for about 2.5 years. And I come back at the end of 2015 or 2016, sorry, and I wanted to I come back from my knee surgery. I wasn't interested in going back in jiu-jitsu at all. And then I went, and my mate was telling me he's been doing acid, and he's got this new room, and it's got all these lights and all this smog, fog things. He's like, you got to come and check it out. I don't do acid, but I wanted to check this out anyway. So we're in there, and he's like, let's roll. And I was thinking, what is this weirdo want to do rolling? This is fucking weird as hell. Okay, let's roll. So I started rolling with him. This is the first time I'd rolled since my knee surgery, and I couldn't do much. But I passed his guard, and I was like, man, this is fun. I want to get back into it. And then I went back into training, and I think Craig Jones was back. And he was he moved to Melbourne. He was training with Lachlan Giles. And they're kind of leading the way in Australian Jiu-Jitsu. And I come back, and from when I was last competing and had no one really to train with and push me, suddenly I've got two guys that are really good. So it was a lot more motivating, and I got back into Jiu-Jitsu. But then I pushed more towards the coaching, and I compete more as a hobbyist now. Uh-huh. But I got back into Jiu-Jitsu, and then I started sort of doing my instructional videos. And I think a lot of it caught on early because I was doing a lot of, you know, sort of funny stuff with it. I don't take, but I don't take myself too seriously in a sense of, in an ego sense. I mean, I'm 100% with what I believe and what I teach and stuff, but I like to have fun as well. And I think a lot of that translated to a lot of people and sort of gave me a bit of a following.
Mm-hmm. I think that's one of the things I do appreciate about you as well. You're a fun guy to be around. I was just saying to my chick the other day, it's always fun when I'm going to meet you somewhere and see you, whether it's in Australia or the US, whatever. I always look forward to it because I know it's entertaining, dude. And that's a special thing to have, dude. Long may it last.
I appreciate that. Thank you. Likewise.
Man, there's so many interesting things about you that I wanted to talk about. And I think the listeners will appreciate them. The first thing is, like, when I met you, one of the first things I noticed is that you're stacked, bro. I mean, you're not the tallest dude, unfortunately, but you are.
What do you mean, unfortunately? The world's bigger for me. It's unfortunate for the tall people. You got less room to move.
Yeah, that's true. That is the one advantage, I guess. But goddamn, I mean, you are stacked. Like, I thought to myself, okay, this guy. I thought that, okay, obviously this guy's going to be good at jiu-jitsu because he's just one of those natural athletic freaks. And then a while later, after we'd been friends for a while, we'd done a bit of business together and some time had passed, I came across this picture of you on the web. I think it's you standing at a barbecue, right? And you got your shirt off. I think it's when you were still before you had done jiu-jitsu.
Yeah.
And man, you weren't in shape at all, dude. I was like, wow.
I was a different body shape back then.
Yeah, and so the thing that came to my mind, it's something that I respect about not just you, but anyone who, you know, there's this expression, right, which is it's about Holland. You know, Holland, the country is made. It was fully submerged underwater, and then basically the Dutch created the series of dikes and reclaimed the land. And there's a saying that the Dutch use, which is God made the world, but the Dutch made Holland. And there's a saying that, you know, dude, I'm not the most naturally athletic guy. You know, I'm not like retarded and like have no physical coordination or no muscle mass or anything like that. But I had to work for my physique and I had to work for my abilities as an athlete and a sportsman. And I always say that, I've got this buddy in France and he's just one of those dudes. He literally looks like he just swung off a tree. He's like built like a gorilla and he's never lifted. You know, those guys who walk past the gym and they just get bigger, right? Yeah, he's one of those, right? Yeah. And I remember once, like, this was long ago and we both had our shirts off. We were working out and we'd just come off the mat and we were doing some push-ups and challenging each other or something. And we got into an argument about something and like friendly banter. And I said to him, yeah, bro, God made you, but I made me, you know, like, and I think, would you say it's safe to say that when it comes to your physical prowess and your physique, that's an accurate description of you as well. Like you built yourself.
Yeah. I think if people had seen me when I was 18 years old, not just physically, but like mentally, you wouldn't even think it was the same person. I had to go through like a massive transition, and like I said, not just physically but mentally. I came from like a place where I had massive anxiety. I was super shy, not confident at all. I was going through bouts of depression. There was times where I got to a stage where I didn't even want to be, you know, alive anymore.
Wow.
And to go from that and to be, and I'm not trying to sound like a victim or anything, but to go from that and be quite small and immature for my age to where I am now was a massive transition. Not to, and also, and it's a silly thing, but I went bald at 21 years old. You know, these are kind of things that affect someone a lot. So it was kind of like, there's a lot of things I needed to get past and grow on. And it's been a really, really fun journey of just, you know, growing as a person. And now I'm getting older. I'm 31 now. I'm not too old, but I'm getting older. And I'm spending less time on the physical side and a lot more time on the mental side. And I'm trying to learn a lot more. And I'm really fascinated by, especially like people now, I find when I'm doing privates, there's always like, especially in LA, there's so many interesting people. I got one guy that's doing a private with me, and he owns like a multi-million dollar company that sells like CBD oils and different different things. And then another guy who's the agent for The Rock. And there's just so many things you can learn off people. And I'm just fascinated with learning now. Like every time I do a private, I tell them, I say, it's an hour private, but you know, be ready to stay for 2 hours because I'm going to ask you some questions. Because they're usually interesting people. And I end up like spending an hour teaching them, but probably an hour listening to them and learning from them as well.
That's awesome. I remember when I was a purple belt in that's how I was making my living when I was training in London to get my black belt. I was teaching at Rogers Academy in London. And I don't know what it is with jiu-jitsu. It might not even be a global thing. It might just be because London's that kind of place. It's a global, it's a financial center and a lot of wealthy people there. But I remember that period of, I think it was about 3 or 4 years when I was heavily focused on the privates. I mean, forget the money the guys paid me for the private lessons, just the value in the network that I built and the lessons that being around those kinds of guys taught me is just, I mean, it's priceless, basically. There's no other way to put it. And it's something I'm extremely grateful for. So another thing, Kit, that I really respect about you. So you just fought in Abu Dhabi, if I'm not mistaken. You lost to Andre Galvao. Is that correct?
No, I lost to Andre Galvao the Worlds in the quarterfinals.
The Worlds, sorry. That's what I was
saying. I lost to Hamelo Bahal and the ADCC.
Okay, cool. So the example I wanted to use was the match with Andre Galvao. Now, it's my understanding that you lost on an advantage.
No, not that one. I lost to – God, I've lost a few top guys. I'm not sure which one you're thinking. The one I lost to Andre Galvao, that was on points.
Okay.
And
what was the margin? Okay, 2 points, right?
I can't remember. No, I think it was more than that, but I can't remember. It was closer than that, like in realistic sense, but it was a few points, but it was because of it was a kind of style that I had to play at the time. It's kind of a weird situation. I'll let you ask the question first and then I'll tell you about it. But
yeah, well, so, I mean, I think, so you, look, I've rolled with you, and I can say straight up to anyone who doubts it, Kit's no joke, right? You're no joke. World class. Now, you may not be that elite, super 0.00001% like Hamelo Bahal, Roger Gracie, Marcelo Garcia, Cabrinha, and maybe 3 or 4 others, but you're pretty damn close, right? And the thing that I find very interesting, and I think it's one of the biggest reasons that I can recommend you and your work and your methodologies, is that you probably have trained 1/5 the amount as those guys, and you are 99% as good as them. And I think that speaks volumes to the way you study jiu-jitsu and the way you teach jiu-jitsu. Can you explain what you believe the main difference between your style and is, and how it has allowed you to get to that level with relatively less effort than the average world-class jiu-jitsu player?
Well, first of all, I want to thank you for the compliments. It's really nice. I think the biggest difference isn't so much in my style. It's in the process. And it's not that I have picked some amazing process that's, you know, that no one's ever discovered. This process has been available for years. It's just that most people have picked an outdated process. So if we look at jiu-jitsu and the way it's learned, you'd notice massive similarities between that and the industrial age education system, in a sense that you go to class, the The teacher tells you exactly how to do something. You repeat it exactly the way the teacher told you, and then you try and apply it in a scenario that is live. Okay. Mm-hmm. Now, that is exactly what you see in the industrial age education system. And the last part of the industrial age education system was created in the 60s in Chicago to create factory workers. Okay. It's to take all these people with amazing gifts, all these unique individuals, and to batch them and conform them into one model they deem fit. And I feel like it's a completely outdated model, and I feel like that's exactly what's moved in towards the jiu-jitsu realm, okay? So then you take what I look at, the way I do it, and I do it more like an agricultural model, where as a coach, you're more like a farmer that creates the perfect environment for the students to get the best out of themselves. You see, for anyone to get the best out of themselves, it has to be an organic thing. It can't be mechanical. It can't be me or you telling them this is what you have to do. This is how to do it. Otherwise, that's mechanical. That's us trying to push an ideology onto them. It has to be us creating the right environment, like a farmer would, where you dig up the dirt, you plant the seeds, you give them adequate water or information, you give them adequate sunlight, for them to thrive in the best way possible that suits them, that they want to discover themselves. So it's almost like, in a sense, you know, as a coach, the way I look at it is I'm trying to create an environment for someone else to discover themselves. And in jiu-jitsu, that was the exact process that I took in the first place. I wasn't very interested in sitting there listening to what the coach wanted to tell me to do, because I felt a lot of pleasure in discovering it myself. I looked at jiu-jitsu like a ton of problems and a whole problem-solving sort of puzzle, and I liked to do that myself. That's what I found interesting. Mm-hmm. So from an early start, I wasn't too interested in listening to techniques. That, and I looked at the big grand scheme of things. I'm very kind of like I'm very conceptual. I'm very big picture orientated. So I was looking and I'm thinking, well, look at the amount of techniques we learn every single day. We're learning three different techniques every day. If we train 5 days a week, that's 18 techniques. I hope I'm right now.
Mm-hmm. 15. And,
anyway, 18, 15, yeah. Same thing. And you're going to forget most of that. There's no way. Humans only remember a small amount of information per day on per particular subject, and we're learning all these things that we're going to forget. I'm never going to sit there and have 150 sweeps in my head that I can go one from the other. No one is. I think we remember a maximum of 100 things, and then we forget. And that's, you know, in social constructions and everything like that, And you see that, you know, generally a tribe will only be about 100 thick, and then it'll split into two. And so we don't really remember more names than 100, or we don't remember more techniques than 100 or anything like that. So at any one particular time, that's all you're going to have. The moment you learn another is the moment you're going to forget an old one. So my point is there's thousands of techniques in jiu-jitsu, and hundreds are getting invented every week. To master it takes 10,000 repetitions. To spend that much time in jiu-jitsu learning techniques and drilling, and I calculated this, give or take a couple thousand, would take about 550 years training twice a day for 2 hours, drilling all day. That's how long it would take, which is insane. And I thought, well, there's no way that I'm going to go down that path, because I'm never going to understand all of jiu-jitsu. Yes, I could be a specialist and I could get super fit and super strong and go into a competition to win a competition, but competition is not a true indicator of the best guys in jiu-jitsu, or at least the guys who understand the jiu-jitsu the best. Jiu-jitsu is like a game of tennis that finishes in the first match. That's how sport is.
Mm-hmm.
You know, can you imagine a game where you see Roger Federer playing against Rafael Nadal or whatever it is, and they have the first game and then that's it. That's what jiu-jitsu is. Jiu-jitsu should be a game of problem solving. Okay, you caught me, let's go again. Let's figure this out. Let's keep working. Not a sprint. You know, it's like we train for a marathon and then we compete in a sprint lap. Mm-hmm. So to win competition and to be a great competitor doesn't always translate as being a great coach or really understanding jiu-jitsu. And this is the problem that people don't really see. They see the winners and they think, well, he's doing this, so he must be right.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't always mean that way.
It can sometimes. There is sometimes overlap, yeah.
I'm definitely not saying just because you're a good competitor means you're not a good coach or anything. Definitely not. But I'm saying just because you're a great competitor and a world-class competitor does not mean that you're going to be a good coach or that your process is better than anyone else's. Mm-hmm. And this is the problem, is people see this and they think, well, he's doing that. And there's so many different things they don't take into regards, like Tim Ferriss's 80-20 rule. Well, it's not Tim Ferriss, it's Vilfredo Pareto's 80-20 rule. That 80% of your results come from 20% of your actions. Mm-hmm. So if you looked at any one of these world-class competitors, okay, I'm not going to take any names, you looked at them, and you would take 80% of their training and you could almost throw it out because it's giving them such a small return. And these guys are training, you know, 2 to 3 times a day. And this is the biggest difference between them and me right now, is the fact that I'm training probably 3 hours a month and they're training 3 hours a day. So when it comes to a competition, I have not got the fitness to match it with them, which means that I can't go 100%. I've always got to hold myself back. And I've got to be very strategic and you know, and play a certain game with that, which makes it really difficult to win at that level. But my ambitions are not in winning world championships anymore. I compete for myself because I enjoy pushing myself. Plus, I know that the more I prepare for a competition, and the more I give myself, you know, less challenge in that competition, the less room I have to grow. So for me, it's not about getting super fit and you know, imposing my will on someone. I feel like that is going to be wrong, because when you get to a stage that you get older and you don't have that muscle or that athleticism, what are you going to have? Mm-hmm. Nothing.
That's so
for me,
true.
I want to go in there completely unfit and be able to do exactly what I did then in 10 years' time.
Mm, I agree with some of what you've said.
Please step in too, because I know there's a lot of listeners that a lot of this stuff they're going to disagree with or not understand. So if you can be their voice, that'd be great too.
Yeah, well, I don't think I'm going to be their voice specifically, because I definitely don't agree with the classical model of training in its entirety, whereby you take a specific move that the teacher has arbitrarily decided is what he needs to communicate to you, and then you just drill it over and over again. I'm definitely a conceptual learner and teacher first, and that's what I base a lot of my study and my approach to jiu-jitsu on. But look, let's speak about drilling, because this is something, you know, you remind me of Kit. I don't know if you were ever into bodybuilding or ever followed this scene, but there was a guy by the name, I don't want to get his name wrong, but I think it was Mike Mentzer. Do you remember him?
I know the name, but I don't know him.
Okay, so basically Mike Mentzer, the classical bodybuilding methodology or protocol for building muscle was you'd pyramid. So you'd do a set of 12 reps at a certain weight, and then you'd increase the weight and do 10 reps, and then increase it again and do 8 reps, and then increase it again and do 6 reps until failure. You'd do like 5 reps per body part or 10 reps per body part, whatever your specific program called for. And that's basically what Arnold followed. It's what most of Arnold's predecessors followed as well. And that was in the zeitgeist of bodybuilding in the 70s and 80s. That was the way everyone did it, or that was the way most people did it. And then Mike Mentzer came along with what was called the heavy duty training protocol. And this called for, instead of pyramiding up to the specific number of sets that they were using at the time, you just do one set to failure, right? He said all that you really need for muscle growth is to stimulate the muscle to a certain point, and you can do that by taking it to failure in one set. And they used a bunch of different tricks to be able to do that. And there was a big argument at the time, like, because people were having results with heavy-duty training, but Mentzer called out Arnold, and someone said to them, look, why does Arnold not use this, and yet he's Mr. Olympia, and he beat you? And Mentzer said, well, Arnold would have been even better if he had used this, right?
Yeah. No, I said the same thing. That's so funny. I've said the same thing in jiu-jitsu many times. I'm glad to hear someone else say
that. Now, here's the thing. This is where I disagree with you, and this is, we're going to stick with the Mike Mentzer analogy. So when you look more closely at heavy duty training, you realize that they advocate, they say one set to failure, but what they do is a bunch of lighter sets before that, that they call warm up sets, just to get the muscle ready, which basically means that they are doing pyramiding themselves. So not exactly the same as pyramiding would work, but they are using some elements of the older protocol. Even though their protocol, I would say, is more sophisticated, they are still standing on the shoulders of their predecessors. Now, I remember I was doing a lesson with you once, and we were teaching it some, I think it was in Australia, yeah. I was teaching a technique, or I was teaching something, and then you were teaching something, and we were kind of doing like a little clinic for the students. And you showed something, and I remember thinking, okay, he's going to teach this off the wall concept that no one's, that's going to blow everyone's minds. And what you showed was a technique. You showed, like, okay, I still remember very clearly, it was a way of dealing with the leg lasso when someone was using a leg lasso guard on you. And you were saying, okay, mm-hmm. when the guy does this, I put my hand here, and then I move to the side, and then you said, okay, let's practice it. And we mm-hmm. all went off to practice it. And I was like, but this is not really any different from the traditional model, you know, like this mm-hmm. And admittedly, then you came and said, okay, this is the concept I use when it comes to this particular technique. And you, mm-hmm. you showed a concept. And then I was like, okay, cool. I don't know if Kit knows that he's doing this, but he is actually using both of the methods. He is using, albeit a very mild form of drilling and a very strong form of conceptual teaching. And where I'm at with my own approach to jiu-jitsu now is, look, in life, whenever I'm presented with something that is very black and white or very diametric, so someone will say, you can't eat carbs, or you can't eat fat. Like, that's the two basic dietary, that's the two battle groups in the world of nutrition, is like, it's low fat or low carb, right? Mm-hmm. And each one says, okay, you can't have carbs. Another one says, okay, you can't have fats. And I've realized now where I'm at is, you need fat and carbs, and restricting either of them is going to cause an issue, and that you need to have a balanced diet. And where I'm, it's a similar place where I'm at in my jiu-jitsu training, is that, and teaching as well, is I don't think a system built on drilling is adequate, and I don't think a system built just on conceptual learning is adequate. What I'm looking to do is create a fusion of the two of them, because let's be honest, man, from my own experience, and again, everything you've said about the industrialized education system and the fact that learning should be more organic than mechanical, I completely agree with you. I totally agree with you. I hate mechanized approaches to anything. I think it's one of the things I hated most about school. But having said that, I have definitely without question seen improvements in my jiu-jitsu game when I have taken a specific move and practiced it over and over again. Now, it's not a random move. It's something that I've identified, that I find myself in a specific scenario many times, and I need a specific solution to it, because just winging it and just using natural organic problem solving hasn't been working for me. So I might take a technique that someone like Roger or Marcelo Garcia has, using those hundreds and hundreds and thousands of hours of, let's say, for argument's sake, outdated training systems, gotten to work. They've done the work for me, so I can just borrow it. And I've taken that and drilled it, and I've seen an increase in my ability. And I've, you know, it's interesting. One of the things I like to do is draw, right? I love drawing. Mm-hmm. Now, what I do to, I was given this method to practice drawing. This guy said to me, so everything in drawing is either a curved line or a straight line. So what you want to do before you start drawing is just take a blank piece of paper, and you draw a lot of straight, like a bunch of straight lines, like 100 to 200 little straight lines in different directions and different vectors. And then what you do is draw a bunch of circles. You draw 100 to 200 circles, and that's your warm up. Now, that's a form of drilling, right? It's training my muscle memory to get me to be able to create this little shape. Uh-huh. And then when I draw the picture of the man or the plant or the tree or the animal or whatever it is, that muscle memory can be translated over into the actual act of drawing. Now, that doesn't mean that my drawing is going to be mechanical, right? It means that I've used the mechanistic learning process to help facilitate organic action. Does what yeah. I'm saying make sense to you?
Yeah. And, no, duh. I'm just writing down a few things, because there's about five different questions. So I'm just writing down so I make sure that I answer every single one of them.
Okay. So,
but I've got answers for everything.
I guess where I'm at with So you know how we, I've noticed as well in life is there's a lot of theory out there, dude. Like people will tell you, and theory and practice are so different. Like in theory, you should work for 40 years and then retire with your pension at age 65. Like that's the theory, right? And in practice, people are fucking miserable when they do that, and it doesn't work for most people. They retire broke anyway, right? Like, mm-hmm. So to me, I'm just not at the point, and I might get to that point someday, but I've found too much value in repeating specific movements. And it doesn't even mean I repeat them like 500 times. It might even just be 20 or 30 times. And that might be due to the way I learn, but I've seen it with other students as well. I remember one of the things I noticed early on in my teaching career is I had these students who just couldn't get jiu-jitsu, dude. They were just so like, I don't want to say gimpy, but like there's no other word for it. Just uncoordinated. They couldn't remember stuff. And what I got them to do, I'll never forget because I experienced it as well. I was struggling to remember stuff. And then I took one technique, which was the armbar from Closed Guard. And I broke it down into its smaller pieces. And I just practiced that move until I could do it reflexively. And from that point on, it's almost like it unlocked something in my brain. And I could remember all subsequent moves much more easily. And I've seen it with students as well. If I can just get them to that point where they can concentrate and focus enough to commit something to memory, it unlocks a certain part of their mind and allows them to memorize things more easily. Another thing I remember specifically as well is about that arm lock. I drilled it so much. I was in a match once and this guy was in my closed guard. And all I remember is the first two parts of the movement, trap the wrist, trap the elbow. And the next thing I remember was the guy tapping. And I was like, holy shit, what happened? And I realized my body had just done the move before my mind had even caught up with it. Now, I'm very interested to hear your response to this. I know you're going to, and again, I'm not committed to drilling. I wouldn't even consider myself a drilling style teacher or practitioner, but I don't like the idea of just discarding it entirely. Was what I say make sense to you?
Everything we said makes sense. Are you ready?
Yes, hit me.
You're not going to drill again after this. We're done. No. First off, the biggest problem was a misunderstanding of what drilling is in my mind compared to what is in your mind.
Okay.
So drilling for me is drilling after comprehension of a technique. So before, there is a stage in training where I think is fine when you practice a technique or a movement or, you know, something that may be intricate, right? And I practice it. The moment that you know how to do that, take it live. The reason why I say this is because when you drill it, you do create muscle memory, but you create a rigid form of whatever you're drilling. You become rigid and you become predictable. Now, you may drill something and get quite good at it and get good results against other people who drill, but if you do that against someone who's conceptual, they will read you in a heartbeat. And this is the problem is people aren't you're not probably testing this against someone that's conceptual, like a Marcelo Garcia or something like that. Those guys can read everything you do. I think Leo Vieira was very similar. Shunji Hibiero is very similar. Hodger Gracie would be very similar, where you can see they're conceptual type guys.
No, bro, I got to disagree with you there, man. Like, for example, Hodger, he's not a conceptual guy at all. Hodger is, he has a specific formula from every... By the way, there's an ice cream truck in the background. How cool is that? That's awesome. Oh, man, I'm so happy to be in America. Right over us is the, I think it's called the A-10 Warthog. And have you seen that fighter plane? Just going over as well.
Yeah, I've seen, I don't know which one it is.
Yeah, it's so cool because I'm staying near an Air Force base here in Arizona. And that's basically my favorite fighter plane. Anyway, so we've got the ice cream truck and the jets. That's awesome. And again, I'm not arguing with the kid. I just got to point out that Roger is, for example, when Roger puts you in his closed guard, he's, as far as I can tell, as someone who's spent a reasonable amount of time training with the guy and watching the way he teaches and the way he talks and the way he approaches things, what is happening is as he puts you in his closed guard, he starts a sequence. The sequence is first, I will take my grips. Then if I get this grip, I will step on the hip and I will start trying to do this. If he counters, I will do my secondary move, which is that it's very formulaic, right? But here's the caveat that I'm putting to what I've just said now. It's impossible for a 31-year-old man or a 38-year-old man or even a 28-year-old man to emulate a guy like Roger because they haven't been training since they were 7 years old in Brazil. They cannot get to the point where they have that sequential answer to every scenario that's presented to them. And in that way, I think that the idea of concepts is superior because it allows you to bridge that gap in skill without the time commitment. Does that make sense?
It does, but I don't see where you're disagreeing with anything I said, though.
Basically, it was just the like claiming that Roger's more of a conceptual.
Well, I've heard him quote in saying that he hates drilling and he never drills. So that would give me one idea that he's conceptual. And if you watch him carefully, which I have, he never does anything similar. And it's nothing is pushed. Everything is improvisational and it's reactive to whatever his opponent's doing. And he may do the most similar thing, but doesn't mean that it's been from drilling. It could be a very easy way of him using his timing to deceive everyone in the exact same manner, which may look like drilling, but it's not. So if I look at him compared to an Andre Galval, I see a completely different person.
Okay, let's agree to disagree. And now, okay, can you go to the next point that you were addressing? I'm sorry to have interrupted you, Kit.
No, I don't know if we have the time. I'm interested into seeing why you disagree, but that's cool anyway. I can't exactly remember where I was at with them, but my point is when you're drilling and you get better at something, you're going to get better at something when you're drilling, but you're becoming more mechanical, which means you're more predictable. And this is what I get the same question all the time with people, and they're like, I've been drilling a lot because I'm trying to get this and it's not happening, so I'm drilling it more. And then what happens is they become more predictable. And the people can see that, like, for example, shooting and double legs, and they're practicing it over and over again, and they're becoming so predictable what they're doing that they have to drill it more again to try and get quicker because they feel like the speed is the problem here. But as Bruce Lee said, it's not the speed. It's you don't need to be the quickest. You know, if you go too far, if you go too quick, the guy's not there yet.
You have the best timing, basically.
Timing is 80% of jiu-jitsu easily compared to the 20% of technique. And I've seen guys that are they're fundamentally beautiful when they display a technique. But when you put them against rolling against someone, you can see them get turned inside out. And it happens with me a lot of people when I'm training with them. And I see these guys that are very well drilled. And then as soon as we start rolling, I see it all fall away really quickly. Because it's very different when you're going with someone's conception. I'm not saying that I've got some genius way of doing it, but the difference is I learn how to read people. It doesn't translate that well into competition because it's too quick. You don't get a chance to feel anything out.
Mm-hmm.
But I will read someone and I'll learn, and I can tell you within an hour, I can tell you exactly what he's doing after that. And I can see exactly his little telltales of whatever he's doing because he never understood what timing was.
Mm-hmm.
He spent all of his training drilling to get good. I'll tell you right now, my technique is average. Average at best. But I don't need it because my timing is really good.
Mm-hmm.
So I can go against someone in competition that's been training 25 years all of his life and win or just lose and do it unfit because I know how to read him.
Mm-hmm.
I can predict what he's doing, and I'm very unpredictable with what I'm doing. The timing is the key to everything, and this is the thing that most people have no idea about. And when you talk to them, they go, yeah, I do. I drill for timing. Drilling is not for timing. Drilling is for reaction, and you can get reaction speed, but you're becoming very mechanical, and you're looking at jiu-jitsu completely different to what an art is. And if you're only looking at it as a sport form, that's fine. You can go out, you can win. But if you're looking at it as an art to, you know, to like Bruce Lee would say, express yourself honestly,
mm-hmm.
or to articulate it and break down, you'll never do it from anything but a mechanical point of view of A, B, C, D. Now, you can do A, B, C, D quite easily when you understand the concept behind it. So I will, if I have a little bit of time to teach, of course I'm going to show a technique because a concept is hard to grasp. It's hard to articulate and it's very hard to absorb very quickly. So if I, you know, for example, if we're doing something, I might show a technique. I try and explain why I'm doing it more than anything because the why is by far more than the how. And I try and encourage people to not take this as like the be all that ends all. Okay, this is a technique. This is an example of something I use one millionth of the time in jiu-jitsu. This is what I'll do. Now, I'll only do it in this certain situation. And every second in jiu-jitsu, a variable changes, and so must the solution. So unless if you practice something over and over again, muscle memory, you start doing things without thinking. Sometimes it might pay off. Sometimes it's not. Either way, you're not thinking about how you're doing it. You're just practicing, and it's only rote training. So when you ask someone like a question like this that's only learned this way, they'll give you answers only in techniques. But an answer that's in, again, a concept form, it has so much more weight than someone that shows
up. I agree with you. So it's strange, Kit, because I both agree and disagree with you. I totally agree with you, and I totally disagree with you. So let's continue with the Roger example, right?
Yeah.
You know, I was always of the opinion that strategy in jiu-jitsu was a waste of time, because you can have this amazing strategy, but at the end of the day, a jiu-jitsu match is composed of two people trying to impose their will upon each other, and your opponent is, you can develop a specific strategy for his game or what you're expecting him to do, but if he does something different, your strategy falls apart, right? Like if you go in expecting him to do a double leg and you train that and then he pulls guard, you're fucked, right?
Yeah.
Now, if you watch the match of Roger versus Buchecha, I can tell you right now, without a shadow of a doubt, that Roger was training a very specific strategy and a very specific set of technical responses to what he was anticipating Buchecha would do. He knew Buchecha would shoot for the double or the single because that's how, what he does. And he knew that he would push on his head, post on his head, and thwart the single and tire him out doing that. I know because I've seen him teach that single leg defense over and over again. I've seen him teach it in a step-by-step sequential system. I also know that Roger was planning to take the guy's back using that variation of the closed guard arm drag, that arm across the center line back take, because I've seen him teach that and I've seen him not drill it, but I know that he has practiced that enough back in Brazil that he doesn't need to drill it anymore, because back in Gracie Baja, I'm sure his coach showed it to him back in the day and he drilled it maybe 20 times because he's a natural. He had a bunch of success with it. He internalized it, and that's what he shows in class, and that's what that's the strategy and the technical response, or the technical response isn't quite the right word, the reaction that he used to the anticipated moves of Buchecha. So, and the thing is, I want you to be right, because I much prefer just getting on the jiu-jitsu mat and riffing. I think that's much more fun. I don't hate drilling, but I don't find
But Nick, that is not at all what I'm telling people to do. This is, I think your issue isn't actually, I'm failing to articulate this in a way that for you to understand, because nothing you just said then is a contradiction to anything I'm telling or teaching. I think this may be more of a, I'm not sure if I'm explaining it not well enough to you.
Or maybe I'm just not understanding it well, bro. Maybe it's a combination of both.
But, I mean, there's nothing that was said in then that was against what I say. And the thing with Hodja, okay, so he practiced these things and you saw him practice, so you think that he predicted exactly how that was going to go? Is that what you're saying?
Look, I haven't, I'm not in the guy's head, so I don't want to, you know, say that's exactly what he did, but I strongly suspect that that's what happened. He sat down, he strategized that, okay, Buchecha's going to try pull a single because that's his main takedown move. He's a good takedown player. I'm going to thwart the single and I'm going to pull guard and take his back using this specific technique. I'm pretty sure that if we spoke to him now and asked him, that's what he would say.
Yeah, I don't know. I can't tell you unless I spoke to him. But in saying that, if he knew this, then how come his first match with Buchecha was so different?
Yeah, that's a good point. I think he would maybe say, and again, I could be wrong. We need to ask the guy. In fact, I will ask him. He would probably say that he didn't take that match seriously enough and didn't study his opponent enough and he wasn't fit enough.
But see, this is a thing where this has nothing to do with techniques and drilling. This has to do with timing. Because watching someone, you start seeing what they're doing. What is timing? Timing is reading someone. Timing is deceiving someone. It's telling someone you're going left when you're going right. It's trying to convince them that you're doing something other than your actual intention. Mm-hmm. So watching someone and studying someone isn't from a technical standpoint. It's from a conceptual standpoint of he's most likely looking at doing these kind of things, and this is where he's going to go for. So if he does that and he predicts it, it's easy to defend. At this level, is this the ice cream guy?
Yeah, it's awesome. Someone in this neighborhood's going to get diabetes, dude, because this ice cream truck's been by like 4 or 5 times.
That's hilarious.
No, it's cool, man. I'm sure the people don't mind.
So, timing is deceptive.
Kid, you know what's going to be awesome is I'm going to hear an ice cream truck playing in my mind every time you say anything to me from this point forward. Mate.
I'm going to be thinking ice creams.
Sorry, but I think it's almost gone now. That's great. Please continue, my brother.
So I think I was saying that when you're looking at someone, you're really figuring out the timing for things. And when I say timing, I don't mean you're like you're sitting there going, "This is exactly what happens. I'm going to do exactly this," because it doesn't ever work like that. But it gives you a rough outline on what someone's trying to achieve, what someone's most likely going to be doing. And when you know that, then you can predict it. Now, at this level, there's not much difference between the technique. There really isn't. Everyone knows all the techniques that are out there. There's nothing that's hidden these days. You might see some new variation pop up, but, I mean, very seldom does that happen where people don't see it. The biggest difference is how people apply it with their timing. And the timing is a whole nother ballgame. So we can be on the same technical level, but if my timing is better than yours, I'm going to turn you inside out. Because everything you try and do, I'm going to see coming and I'm going to counter it.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a counter for every single counter and it goes on. But having the timing is what's going to allow you to do anything. And if you can't do it, it's because you telegraphed it. It's like throwing a punch. Anyone can throw a punch. Everyone can close their eyes, throw a punch, knock someone out. But the timing is what you need. You need
That's to so true.
And so what I'm telling people is to concentrate on the timing. Make that your one, like your main focus. The technical stuff will come. It'll naturally occur through repetition, through muscle memory, but it's all live repetition.
Yes, yes.
Now, if you're a beginner, I have no problem with you doing that, but I try and encourage away from it because the fundamentals in jiu-jitsu, in my opinion, are not hip escapes, they're not arm bars, they're not rear naked chokes. That's more like they're like the ice cream on the cake. For me, the fundamentals are the concepts that allow you to have a good, strong base, to have really good posture, to have very nice, smooth movement, to get you in the habit of not only thinking about what you're doing, but reading your opponent. And so many, like lately, my privates have been even like far beyond the normal concepts of technical concepts and more into the psychological concepts of, you know, of getting people to move, getting people to do certain things for you, how to convince someone you're doing this when you're really doing that. It's almost like a deception sort of thing.
Getting them to relax is almost could be considered a fundamental as well. Getting them to just
exactly
be aware of their own breath and their the feeling of what rolling around is. It's one of the things I think is very helpful to beginner students as well, is just a flow drill whereby it's and a very loose flow drill, which is basically two guys just rolling over each other and tumbling, right? Eyes closed, just like doing forward rolls and flips and whatever, and just getting used to that feeling of your body moving through space and connecting with the ground and having another human being moving on and around you. And that could be considered the most primary fundamental of all. Maybe being able to coordinate your breathing and your movement would be another one. But
that should be a warm up or something.
Yeah, yeah. I'm starting to understand what you mean a little bit more. That was very illuminating, Kit. You're a very smart guy, and I appreciate the way you stuck with me through that conversation, because at the beginning I didn't understand it's not that I didn't understand. I was seeing from the incorrect perspective, and you brought me around in the end. So I really appreciate that.
I appreciate you giving me the chance to. And I promise the same thing. I know you're a smart man, And I know we're on the same page. It's just trying to, this is such a, it's such a hard thing to really break down and articulate so simply. It really is. And sometimes it takes so long. A lot of the things that I teach now, I heard from other people years ago, mm-hmm. but it never made sense to me until this, until it sort of things clicked. I'm like, ah, that's what they meant. You know, mm-hmm. many of my lessons are lessons that I learned in business. I learned in life. I learned as a kid, you know, things like that. But the biggest problem right now, and this is something I'm getting much better at though, is articulating this. So mm-hmm. I get a lot of hate online, but I've never gotten hate from anyone that's understood, you know, correctly what I'm trying to say. And that's not just their fault. It's my fault as well.
Well, I'm really working on. I think that from my perspective, anyone who's trained with you, that's the thing. The hate that you're going to get online is from, I don't know, like some dude, blue belt, sitting in his mom's basement somewhere who's got nothing better to do than, do you know what I mean? Like anyone who's trained, look, I can't discount what you're saying. If you tell me this is the way I've trained and it works for me, I've sparred with you, bro. I know it works. Like there's definitely something, and I'll tell you straight up, there's something different about your game as well. I could feel it's excellent. But it's not just that it's excellent. There's something I could feel when you said, now that you mentioned, I understand. You said you'd worked me out. It's exactly that. All the things that I would usually do just wouldn't work. And it's because you were interrupting the patterns that I was trying to impose upon the match. I get it. I guess it's cool that we can have this conversation. And I really appreciate you coming on the show, Kit. Thank you very much, dude. I'm getting a little bit tired now. The jet lag is catching up with me, so I'm starting to ramble a little bit, so I'm going to have to end it here. Hopefully, the listeners will pick up Beyond Technique 1 and 2, and they'll be able to understand just what you're talking about. What's next for you, Kit? You're going to be spending some time in Los Angeles for the next few months, right?
Yeah, I'll be in LA for next 2 months. We wanted to stop and do some products because I'd made a few products the last couple of years, and my own ones, the Art of Learning Jiu-Jitsu Volume 1 and 2, which have gone like amazing. And that is really where I talk about my approach to learning Jiu-Jitsu and how to learn conceptually and what I did. And they were going really well, and I wanted to film a third one, which we've just done, and this is for No-Gi. And I think it's really bridging a gap massively in jiu-jitsu between gi and no gi, because a lot of people go from without having grips to, you know, not knowing how to use grips. So I'm trying to give people a conceptual understanding of what to do for no gi, and a few other products more for towards coaches as well. So I wanted to get that up and ready, and then at the end of March I'm going to be doing a seminar tour. I'm going to be doing a bit of the US, then I'll be going to Australia, New Zealand, Europe, and then I'll be coming and moving back to back in LA somewhere, probably West Hollywood, and setting up a place in my house to keep teaching online and do privates and stuff like that.
No, it's going to be good to have you living out this side of the world, man, and I look forward to seeing you in Los Angeles. I think next month I'm going to make a trip up there. We should also consider doing Beyond Technique 3 at some point, because trilogies are just naturally cool formats for stuff, right? And I think I know my conceptual understanding has progressed since we made Beyond Technique 2, and I know you're always learning as well, so I'm sure.
Hell yeah, man.
Yeah, I'm
Hell
sure yeah. That would be cool. Kit, dude, what a pleasure chatting to you, my brother.
No worries, mate. It's good to speak to you.
It's always illuminating speaking to Kit, and as I said in the intro, I really appreciate the fact that he's an original. And he doesn't give a fuck that what he says is not the regular interpretation or the classical way that jiu-jitsu is taught. He just goes with what he believes in and what he has seen and feels works. I found that quite quite a difficult conversation to have, because Kit, you know, I really try to be flexible and open-minded. And one of the things that happened, especially towards the end of, or the second half of the show, is I realized that I had taken a position, and I wouldn't say I was argumentative, but I was trying to defend something, and there came a point where I couldn't understand why I was trying to defend it, and I realized it was just my ego hanging on. And that's something I found quite difficult when I recognized that, because, you know, I'm 38 years old now, kid's 31, so he's still, you technically can't call me a young man anymore, but 31 is still, I would say, a young man. And I remember when I was coming up, especially when I started my career teaching jiu-jitsu, I was considered one of those people who was a very fresh and innovative thinker. And I noticed during that conversation now that between those two parties, myself and Kit, he was the fresh and innovative thinker, and my thought patterns had become stale and were a little bit rigid, and that was quite a difficult thing for me to identify. I guess the cool thing is that I'm aware of it, so I can work on it. But it's never easy seeing those or recognizing those things about yourself. But anyway, it's something I got to work on, I guess. So guys, that was the first episode recorded, as I said, in my new home in the States. I'm really, really happy to be here, and I feel really good energy. It was such a long and arduous process to get here and to be with my girl. And, you know, I really do believe that whenever you want something and whenever you want to do something big in your life, that the universe is going to test you to see if you're serious about it. And just the fact that I'm sitting here talking to you guys in the USA, there were a lot of tests to get through to get here, man. So I really value it, and I want to bring you guys cool stuff in 2018. I want to bring you good quality products. I want to bring you great podcasts, and I just want to help grow the Jiu-Jitsu Brotherhood, because that's what we all are. So guys, signing out, episode 25. And we'll be back next week with, I think, Henry Akins, who's another blockbuster jiu-jitsu guest. I think you guys are going to love that one too. Until then, peace out.